Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. The first half of this episode is a speech by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington, on February 22, 2025. The theme of the conference was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. In the second half, we'll hear Brad Wolf's speech at the 26th Annual Qatari Peace Conference, held in Fonda, New York on September 13th and 14th, 2024. Brad Wolf is Executive Director and Co-Founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. A former lawyer, prosecutor, professor, and community college dean, he recently edited a new book of the writings of Philip Berrigan entitled A Ministry of Risk. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. And now, Chris Hedges.
For several decades, I and a handful of others, Sheldon Wolin, Noam Chomsky, Chambers Johnson, Cornel West, Barbara Ehrenreich, Ralph Nader, and of course Jill Stein and Shama Sawant, warned that the expanding social inequality and capture of our democratic institutions, including the media, the Congress, organized labor, academia, and the courts by corporations and oligarchs would inevitably lead to an authoritarian and finally Christian fascist state. My books, American Fascists, The Christian Right, and the War on America, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, Death of the Liberal Class, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, written with Joe Sacco, Wages of Rebellion, and America the Farewell Tour were a succession of impassioned pleas to take the decay seriously. But I take no joy in being correct. The rage of those abandoned by the economy, the fears and concerns of a beleaguered and insecure middle class, and the numbing isolation that comes with the loss of community will be the kindling for a dangerous mass movement, I wrote in American Fascists in 2007. If these dispossessed are not reincorporated into mainstream society, if they eventually lose all hope of finding good, stable jobs and opportunities for themselves and their children, in short, the promise of a brighter future, the specter of American fascism will beset the nation. This despair, this loss of hope, this denial of a future leads the desperate into the arms of those who promise miracles and dreams of apocalyptic glory. Donald Trump does not herald the collapse of democracy. He heralds the ripping away of the veneer that masks the rot within the ruling structures and their pretense of democracy. He is the symptom, not the disease. The loss of basic democratic norms began long before Trump. Deindustrialization, deregulation, austerity, unchecked predatory corporations, including the healthcare industry, wholesale surveillance of every American, social inequality, an electoral system defined by legalized bribery, endless and futile wars, the largest prison population in the world, and the feelings of betrayal, stagnation, and despair, combined in a toxic brew that has culminated in an inchoate and justified hatred of the ruling class. And the Democrats are as guilty as the Republicans. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and moral deviants play the role of the Snopes Clan in some of William Faulkner's novels I wrote in America, the farewell tour. The Snopeses filled the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Phlegm Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the scum now elevated to the highest level of the federal government. They embody the moral decay unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition, driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers or muzhiks drifting in from nowhere and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force, Howe writes. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo, scavengers without inhibition. They need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds. The political philosopher Sheldon Wolin called our system of governance inverted totalitarianism, one that kept the old iconography, language, symbols, but had handed the internal levers of power to corporations and the rich. Now we are shifting to totalitarian's more recognizable form, one dominated by a demagogue and an ideology grounded in our homegrown Christian fascism. We live in a two-tiered legal system, one where poor people are harassed, arrested and jailed for absurd infractions, such as selling loose cigarettes, which led to Eric Garner being choked to death by the New York City police in 2014, while crimes of appalling magnitude by the oligarchs and corporations, from oil spills to bank fraud in the hundreds of billions of dollars, which wiped out 40% of the world's wealth, are dealt with through tepid administrative controls, symbolic fines, and civil enforcement that give these wealthy perpetrators immunity from criminal prosecution, I wrote in America, the Farewell Tour. The utopian ideology of neoliberalism and global capitalism is a vast con, a mechanism to funnel wealth upwards to the billionaire class. The working poor, whose unions and rights were stripped from them and whose wages have stagnated or declined over the past 40 years, have been disempowered and impoverished. Their lives, as Barbara Ehrenreich chronicled in Nickel and Dimed, are one long, stress-ridden emergency. The middle class is evaporating. Cities that once manufactured products and offered factory jobs are boarded up wastelands. The destruction of trade barriers is a ruse corporations and the billionaire class use to stash $1.42 trillion in profits in overseas banks to avoid paying taxes. The labels liberal and conservative are meaningless, evidenced by a Democratic presidential candidate who turned to Wall Street bankers to formulate her economic policies and bragged about an endorsement from Dick Cheney, a war criminal who left office with a 13% approval rating. Fascism is always the bastard child of a bankrupt liberalism. The attraction of Trump is that, although vile and buffoonish, he mocks the political charade. Trump lies like he breathes, but the lies told by the two establishment parties, caused far more pain and did far more damage than the lies told by Trump. Trump is merely the apotheosis of a culture of mendacity, deception, and exploitation, for we are a culture awash in lies. It no longer matters what is true, it matters only what is correct. The correct ideology of neoliberalism is as delusional as the correct ideology of the Christian fascists. Neither are reality-based belief systems. Totalitarianism elevates the brutal and the stupid, those with no genuine political philosophy other than a lust for wealth and power. Empty, mind-numbing cliches and slogans, most of which are absurd and contradictory, replace political discourse. And this is as true for the Christian right as it is for those who preach free market economics and globalization. The illusions peddled on our screens, including the fictitious persona created for Trump on The Apprentice, have replaced reality. Politics is burlesque, as Kamala Harris's vapid, celebrity-filled, issueless campaign illustrated. It is smoke and mirrors created by an army of agents, publicists, marketing departments, promoters, pollsters, script writers, wardrobe consultants, and public announcers. Our money-drenched, heavily managed elections are little more than totalitarian plebiscites designed to give a veneer of legitimacy to oligarchic and corporate power. The political malaise is mirrored in a cultural malaise, what Soren Kierkegaard calls a sickness unto death, the numbing of the soul by nihilism. The cult of the self dominates our cultural landscape. I wrote an Empire of Illusion. This cult has within it the classic traits of psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity, and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, and manipulation, and the inability to feel remorse or guilt. This is, of course, the ethic promoted by corporations. It is the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It is the misguided belief that personal style and personal advancement, mistaken for individualism, are the same as democratic equality. In fact, personal style, defined by the commodities we buy or consume, has become a compensation for our loss of democratic equality. We have a right in the cult of the self to get whatever we desire. We can do anything, even belittle and destroy those around us, including our friends, to make money, to be happy, to become famous. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. How one gets there is irrelevant. Once you get there, those questions are no longer asked. My book, Empire of Illusion, begins in Madison Square Garden at a World Wrestling Entertainment Tour. I understood that professional wrestling was the template for our social and political life, but I did not know that it would produce a president, and soon a secretary of education, who has vowed to shut the department down. The bouts are stylized rituals I wrote in what could have been a description of a Trump rally. They are public expressions of pain and a fervent longing for revenge. The lurid and detailed sagas behind each bout, rather than the wrestling matches themselves, are what drive crowds to a frenzy. These ritualized battles give those packed in the arenas a temporary, heady release from mundane lives. The burden of real problems is transformed into fodder for a high-energy pantomime. It is not going to get better. The tools to shut down dissent have been cemented into place. Our democracy cratered years ago. All Trump has to do to establish a naked police state is flip a switch. any will. The worse reality becomes, the less a beleaguered population wants to hear about it, I wrote at the conclusion of Empire of Illusion, and the more it distracts itself with squalid pseudo-events of celebrity breakdowns, gossip, and trivia. These are the debauched revels of a dying civilization. The system is not reformable. Either we obstruct in the only form left to us, which is mass mobilization, acts of sustained civil disobedience, especially the strike, or we are frog-marched into serfdom. To be innocent now in the eyes of the state is to be guilty. It is to be complicit in this radical evil. It is to bear the mark of Cain. It is to do nothing, to defend the weak, the oppressed, the poor, and those who suffer, and to protect the planet. Choose, but choose fast. Time is running out. The sick, unable to afford care, are dying. The poor, especially children, are going hungry. Families, along with the mentally ill, are thrown into our streets. The unemployed and underemployed are desperate. Schools are being defunded and privatized. Our prisons are packed. The undocumented are being hunted down, imprisoned, and deported. Our roads, bridges, dams, levees, power grids, rail lines, subways, bus services are crumbling. The ecosystem is disintegrating as temperatures rise and freak weather patterns, wildfires, hurricanes, droughts, flooding, tornadoes, melting polar ice caps and glaciers drive desperate migrants northwards from the global south. This is the dystopia of the ruling global class, the ruling capitalists, are shoving down our throats. No social or revolutionary movement succeeds without a core of people who will not betray their vision and their principles. In other words, like all of us here, militants. They are the building blocks of social change. They are our only hope for a viable socialism. They are willing to spend their lives as political outcasts. They are willing to endure repression. They refuse to sell out the oppressed and the poor. They know that you stand with all of the oppressed, those in our prisons and marginal communities, the poor, unemployed workers, our LGBTQ community, undocumented workers, the mentally ill, and the Palestinians, or you stand with none of the oppressed. They know that when you fight for the oppressed, you get treated like the oppressed. And liberals plead with us to believe in the ultimate goodness of the ruling class, the fantasy that justice and social equality can be achieved through their bankrupt institutions, including the Democratic Party, even though, like Herod of old, they repeatedly sell us out. We are castigated for our anger, our alienation from the centers of power, and our bleakness. We are told to adopt a positive attitude, to trust the system, that we can awaken the dead consciences of the atrophied souls, the plutocrats running Amazon, Halliburton, Goldman Sachs, ExxonMobil, and Citibank, and the two ruling parties. I cannot count how many times I have been told this. But this is the road to despair, not hope. Hope comes when we physically defy those in power. Those who succumb to apathy or complicity are enemies of hope, and they become, in their passivity, agents of injustice. Hope has a cost. Hope is not comfortable or easy. Hope requires personal risk. Hope does not come with the right attitude. Hope is not about peace of mind. Hope is action. Hope is doing something. The more futile, the more useless, the more irrelevant and incomprehensible an act of rebellion is, the vaster and more potent hope becomes. Hope never makes sense. Hope is absurd. Hope knows that an injustice visited on our neighbor is an injustice visited on us all. Hope posits that people are drawn to the good by the good. And this is the secret of hope's power. It is why it can never finally be defeated. Hope demands for others what we demand for ourselves. Hope does not separate us from them. Hope sees in our neighbor, even our enemy, our own face. And the powerful do not understand hope. Hope is not part of their vocabulary. They speak in the cold, dead words of national security, global markets, electoral strategy, stain on message, image, and profits. The powerful protect their own. They divide the world into the damned and the blessed, the patriots and the traitors, the rich and the poor. They insist that extinguishing lives in foreign wars or in our prison complexes is a form of human progress. They cannot see that the suffering of a child in Gaza or a child in the blighted pockets of Washington, D.C., diminishes and impoverishes us all. They are deaf, dumb, and blind to hope. Those addicted to power, consumed by self-exaltation, cannot decipher the words of hope any more than most of us can decipher hieroglyphics. Hope to Wall Street bankers and politicians, to the masters of war and commerce, is not practical, it is gibberish. It means nothing. I cannot promise you it will be easy. I cannot assure you that tens of thousands will join us. I cannot pretend that going to jail is pleasant. I cannot say that anyone in Congress, anyone in the boardrooms of the corporations that cannibalize our nation, anyone in the press will be moved to pity to act for the common good. I cannot tell you these wars will end, or the hungry will be fed. I cannot say that justice will roll down like a mighty wave and restore our nation to sanity. But I can say this: if we resist and carry out acts, no matter how small, of open defiance, hope will not be extinguished. Hope cannot be sustained if it cannot be seen. Any act of rebellion, any physical defiance of those who make war, of those who perpetuate corporate greed and are responsible for state crimes, anything that seeks to draw the good to the good, nourishes our souls and holds out the possibility that we can touch and transform the souls of others. Hope affirms that which we must affirm, and every act that imparts hope is a victory in itself. I saw the power of hope in the mass movements in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania that brought down these regimes. These uprisings were spontaneous outbursts by an enraged population that had had enough of repression, mismanagement, and corruption. No one, from the dissidents themselves to the ruling communist parties, anticipated these revolts. They erupted, as all revolutions do, from tinder that have been waiting years for a spark. That this tinder exists in American society is undeniable, although to date, its primary expression has been fascistic. These revolutions were led by a handful of dissidents who, until the fall of 1989, were marginalized and dismissed by the state as inconsequential. The state periodically sent state security to harass them. It often ignored them. I am not even sure you could call these dissidents an opposition. They were profoundly isolated within their own societies. The state media denied them a voice. They had no legal status and were locked out of the political system. They were blacklisted. They struggled to make a living. But when the breaking point in Eastern Europe came, when the ruling communist ideology lost all credibility, there was no question in the minds of the public about whom they could trust. The demonstrators that poured into the streets of East Berlin and Prague were aware of who would sell them out and who would not. They trusted those such as Václav Havel, who had dedicated their lives to fighting for an open society, those who had been willing to be condemned as non-persons and go to jail for their defiance. And no matter how tempting it was to give up, to make compromises with power, they did not. Julian Benda reminds us that we can serve two sets of principles: privilege and power, or justice and truth. The more we make compromises with those who serve privilege and power, the more we diminish the capacity for justice and truth. Our strength comes from our steadfastness to justice and truth, a steadfastness that accepts that the corporate forces arrayed against us may crush us, but that the more we make compromises with those who serve privilege and power, the more we diminish our own strength. Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Popper says this is the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, he writes, have rarely been above average, either morally or intellectually, and often below it. The question is how do we build mass movements to hold the powerful to account even when those in power come from our own ranks. There is a moment in Henry Kissinger's memoirs, Do Not Buy the Book, when Nixon and Kissinger are looking out at tens of thousands of anti-war protesters who have surrounded the White House. Nixon had placed empty city buses in front of the White House to keep the protesters back. He worried out loud that the crowd would break through the barricades and get him and Kissinger. And that is exactly where we want people in power to be. This is why, although he was not a liberal, Nixon was our last liberal president. He was scared of movements. And if we cannot make the elites scared of us, we fail. This is our calling. Our failure to immediately build a counterweight to the Democratic Party after it abandoned the working class with the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994 was our gravest mistake. And this mistake was compounded by allowing liberals to herd us repeatedly into the embrace of the Democratic Party, promising it could be changed from within, that the corporate indentured party leadership would ever permit Bernie Sanders to be the nominee, or the stated goals of his platform to be embraced is delusional. Alex de Tocqueville correctly saw that when citizens can no longer participate in a meaningful way in political life, political populism is replaced by a cultural populism of sameness, resentment, and mindless patriotism, and by a form of anti-politics he calls democratic despotism. Only 11.3% of workers in this country belong to unions. This is the lowest percentage in 80 years, and nearly all these unions, especially the AFL-CIO, have been emasculated by corporate power. We are not going to be assisted in our revolt by established unions. Union leaders such as the Teamster Sean O'Brien are bought off, they are comfortable, they are pulling down at least five times what rank and file workers make. They have sold out to the Democratic Party, or in the case of O'Brien, to Trump. We forget, as Alexander Herzen said, that we are not the doctors, we are the disease. We have to mount protests not only outside the doors of Walmart and Amazon, not only outside congressional offices, but outside the doors of union headquarters. There is no established institution we can trust. They are broken. But there are 30 million working poor, victims of mass layoffs, trapped in debt peonage, manipulated and used by the political elite, willing to rise up if we stop our virtue signaling and woke purity tests and speak to them in the language of class warfare. And this is why I support Workers' Strike Back. But let us be clear-eyed about what lies ahead. The enemies of freedom throughout history have always charged its defenders with subversion. The enemies of freedom have always convinced segments of a captive population to parrot back cliches to justify their rule and serve as goons and vigilantes in the name of patriotism. Those who created our mafia economy inevitably created our mafia state. And we must organize and organize fast to break our chains, one by one, to use the power of the strike to cripple the state machinery. We must embrace a militant radicalism, one that offers a new vision and a new social structure. We must hold fast to moral imperatives. We must forgive mortgage and student debt, institute universal health care, and break up monopolies. We must raise the minimum wage and end the squandering of hundreds of billions of dollars to sustain the empire and the war industry. We must establish a nationwide jobs program to rebuild the country's collapsing infrastructure. We must take into public ownership the banks, the pharmaceutical corporations, military contractors, and transportation and end the extraction of fossil fuel. And we must end the genocide in Gaza. And that means the boycott, sanction, and divestment of the apartheid state of Israel. None of this will happen until we organize and refuse to walk away from our commitment to justice and to socialism. As the country disintegrates, as feelings of betrayal and abandonment mount, the ruling class will use their organs of propaganda, including the media, to blame us, those in open defiance of authority, for the chaos. The mafia state will be brutal. Capitalists, as Eduardo Galeano writes, view communal cultures as enemy cultures. The billionaire class will do to us what it did to the radicals who rose up to form militant unions in the past. We had the bloodiest labor wars in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were killed. Tens of thousands were beaten, wounded, jailed, and blacklisted. Unions were infiltrated, shut down, and outlawed. We cannot be naive. It will be difficult, costly and painful, but this confrontation is our only hope. Otherwise, we and the planet that sustains us are doomed. And I concede, we may not succeed. So be it. At least those who come after us, and I speak as a father, will say we tried. The corporate forces that have us in their death grip will destroy the lives of my children. They will destroy the lives of your children. They will destroy the ecosystem that makes life possible, and we owe it to those who come after us not to be complicit in this evil. We owe it to them to refuse to be good Germans. This is a battle, quite literally, between freedom and slavery, between life and death. It is that grave. And it is a battle that no matter the odds, we must fight. But in the end, I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard a speech by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington on February 22, 2025. The theme of the conference was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. Next, we'll hear Brad Wolf's speech at the 26th Annual Qatari Peace Conference held in Fonda, New York on September 13th and 14th, 2024. Brad Wolf is executive director and co-founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. A former lawyer, prosecutor, professor, and community college dean, he recently edited a new book of the writings of Philip Berrigan entitled A Ministry of Risk.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, John, Maureen, for organizing this and for all of you coming. It's really an honor to be here. I've been reading about the Qatari Peace Conference for a while, so it's great to be here with everybody. I want to work with the theme about what's love got to do with it, because that's what it comes down to. That's why we're here, and that's why we're going to continue to be on this planet. So lately, I've been spending a lot of time reading about World War I, and specifically the poets of World War I, because I'm haunted by this war where the poets died in the trenches, hooded with gas masks and scribbling out their elegies. And the fields and the forest where that war took place in World War I, those fields and forests had been the inspiration for artists for centuries, for painters and for writers and composers. But now those fields in World War I were a boneyard, littered with the corpses of 10 million men. And over 25,000 miles of trenches had been dug in those idyllic fields, scarred the land. And yet, these soldier poets love life enough to memorialize what was going on in verse. They talked about the beauty of life, the beauty of their comrades, and they talked about the waste of humanity in their poems. Their anger and the revulsion of war was born out of love. Some of you may be familiar with some of these poets, Rupert Brooke and Robert Graves, Alan Seeger, Siegfried Sassoon, and of course, Wilfred Owen are the more notable poets of that time. And England, the reason there were so many poets, England had just created its most educated generation ever, thanks to a lot of Edwardian reforms that had gone into effect mandating education. And so they took their most educated generation and they sent them off to slaughter. And so many of them died in the trenches. Some of them survived. But if love could survive in that boneyard of 10 million corpses, it is indeed a force more powerful. So it can conquer what we're up against today. In 1922, the poet T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland, and it's probably the most famous poem of the 20th century. And when he was talking about the wasteland, he was referring to those war-torn fields of World War I. And he begins that poem with the famous line that we all know, April was the cruelest month. And he says that because Eliot feared that nothing would ever again grow on that land. He thought that we had killed the land and that April's unfulfilled promise, when it comes around every spring and promises regrowth and regeneration, would not be met, and it would remind us of what we had done. And so therefore, it would be the cruelest month. Better that we be covered in forgetful snow, he wrote. So we killed the land then, just as we're killing the land now. And, you know, I turn to poets because war is just so incomprehensible to me. And the artists, they help me to understand it. The history books don't really do it for me at times. Because when I read about all the mechanized killing of civilians, the burning of the land, the destruction of hospitals and schools, I need help from others to try to figure this out and why this happens. And the artists, they not only render this back to us in a transformative way, but they tell us that we're not alone in seeing what we see, because they see it too. And this is really important for us. We're not crazy. We're not crazy when we're outraged at what we see in the world, the suffering in the world. We're not crazy when we see so many other people going about their daily chores, seemingly oblivious to what's going on. It's not fine. This community here and so many like them affirm our sanity, and that's why it's important for us to be in community. We've talked about that last night and even this morning. These communities are really important because we need to look into each other's eyes and affirm our sanity and the rightness of what we are doing. And when we go home, even if it's just a team of two, a community of two, we need to do that because when we're alone, it's easy to get disheartened. But when we're together, we can do what the poets do. We can affirm our sanity. So weapons are the antithesis of love. They're not going to save us from war, and they're not going to save the planet. And diplomacy, without humanity, without the force of love, cannot save us, since that is mere words on paper. And even international laws will be disregarded in war, as we can see in Gaza and Ukraine, unless there's a force greater than punishment obligating the parties to abide by them. And so underlying all of that has to be the cultivation of a shared humanity. That needs to be the educational part of today, the component of today. We have to educate ourselves toward our better angels, toward that beloved community that Dr. King spoke about. And I don't think this is naive or idealistic or fanciful to talk about. It's practical, it's possible, and it's necessary. A curriculum at home and at schools for a culture of compassion, as opposed to creating a culture of militarism. And when we talk about love and how that can save us, the kind of love we're talking about is based on the respect that a living thing, a thing pulsating with life, was not and cannot be created by human hands. It lives by the force of something else. And it's the same something else that created us. And so we have no right to kill it. We have no right to extinguish it, whether it be people or the planet. So part of this process of education has to come with the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think that we as Americans need to change the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and what we are. We have a certain idea that we're the shining city on the hill and that we're always right in our foreign policy and that we're coming to the aid of so many others. This is sort of a narrative that goes hand in glove with the narrative of militarism. But we live by the stories that we always have as people, whether they be poems, you know, or whether they be plays, whether they be novels. But we tell ourselves stories to help us identify who we are. And if we can change the stories that we tell by acknowledging our past, we can make a better future. And acknowledging the past means coming to terms with what we've done in the past. And therefore, those stories can be empowering. They're not going to take us down. They're not going to weaken us. They're going to lift us up. You know, I'll go back to the poets of World War I. They were telling stories, too, these poets, when they were in the trenches. And some of those poets didn't live long enough in that war to be repulsed by what they had seen. So some of the poets, like Rupert Brooke and Alan Seeger, were writing poems that were glorifying war. You know the poem, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death" by Alan Seeger? "I have a rendezvous with death at some barricade, and I will not fail that rendezvous." So this was a guy that was really hyped on the glorification of war. And the first chance he got to go over the top and run into battle, he was machine gunned to death. He was killed. Same was true with Rupert Brooke, who was considered the most talented and the most handsome young man in all of England. An extraordinary, talented individual who was killed very early by the war. Some of those poets live long enough to be repulsed by the war, like Wilfred Owen, who of course wrote, "If you would see what I see in war, you would never again tell the old lie, dulce et decorum est," which is that it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. So that's changing the stories that we tell, right? That's going from a glorification to a realism about what war is and what we should be doing. So as we drill down to the facts and the stories we need to tell, Just let me go over a couple facts here. According to ICANN, in 2023, the nine nuclear-armed states spent a combined total of $91 billion on their nuclear arsenal. That's equivalent to $2,898 a second. ICANN's latest report shows $10 billion more was spent on nuclear weapons in 2023 than in 2022. And of course, the United States' total share of nuclear spending, $51 billion, is more than all the other nuclear-armed countries put together. And the average daily operating cost for a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier is $6 million a day. $6 million a day. So adding to this waste of resources, the U.S. military is the greatest institutional polluter in the world, belching out more emissions than industrialized nations like Portugal or Denmark. The U.S. military buys 270,000 barrels of oil a day. That's 100 million barrels a year. So we're talking about this connection between climate and war and militarism. Here it is, with the facts, with the numbers. According to NOAA, July 2024 was the warmest July on record in its entire 175-year record-keeping. Species are going extinct at an alarming rate, and we're creating massive numbers of both war and climate refugees. Drought, fire, flood, and famine are now the norm. And this is this interlocking of war and death, death of the people, death of the planet. This is the creation of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland that he was writing about. That was 100 years ago he was writing about it, 1922. Here we are today dealing with it. The decision to take this nation's wealth and build doomsday devices is a culture of death that we have to relentlessly resist every moment of every day. We can't have our fellow citizens worshiping the bomb, or worshiping our military, or worshiping our weapons, thinking that they're going to keep us safe, because they won't. And so we have to recreate nonviolent resistance for the current moment. And I spoke about this last night. How do we recreate it for the present day? Our imagination is going to have to be more powerful than corporate wealth and influence. And that's where we have the edge, because corporations don't have that. They don't have imagination. We've got the creativity and we've got the will to do this. So we're going to have to think about how do we distill the issue to its essence and gather around that and collaborate around that. We talked about Gandhi's Salt March and Phil Berrigan with the blood on the draft files. Think about how long it must have taken Phil Berrigan and his colleagues to come up with the idea of draft files and then pouring blood on them. That didn't just happen. That was a very thoughtful process that they went into. And the plowshares actions, you know, literally hammering on the nose cones of nuclear weapons to beat swords into plowshares. You know, very thoughtful, very creative, practical and symbolic actions. So those are the things that we should probably concentrate on doing today. One of the things that we did with the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal is to try to take a different approach, is to use a people's tribunal to go after U.S. weapons manufacturers. And a people's tribunal occurs when the courts and the government have been captured by the criminals. And so what's left but for the citizens to gather together and to try to hold accountable the culprits for crimes against humanity and for war crimes and for genocide. So with the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, I worked with Kathy Kelly and Nick Modden over several years, and we gathered evidence. We worked with lawyers and investigators. We interviewed witnesses. We interviewed military analysts, retired military officers. We had lawyers working for us, and we created videos, 37 videos or approximately 30 minutes each, and they documented the fact that U.S. weapons makers have violated war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide as defined by the Rome Statute of the ICC. And we picked four weapons manufacturers just to be representative of all weapons manufacturers, and that was Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and we picked the drone maker, General Atomics, because we wanted to bring drone warfare into it. And again, this was just a way to be creative. We came up with subpoenas that we served on these corporations. Some of you participated in that serving of subpoenas because we did it across the country simultaneously on the same day. And it was a really cool thing to look out and see so many different groups in different parts of the country delivering the subpoenas, writing their names on them, going to the corporate headquarters, and trying to get in the doors. We did that in Arlington, where the four companies were located, the headquarters. Sometimes we got in the doors. Sometimes we got to speak, such as at Boeing, with a director of communications. They came down to receive the subpoena, and we were able to present that to them. Other times they called the police. That was good, too. Whatever it took, you know, it gathered attention. It got in the press. The Washington Post picked it up. We served contempt citations. Some of us risked arrest. Some of us were arrested. But again, a people's tribunal is a really wonderful way to communicate a lot of information in a format that people can find comprehensible, right? Because people like legal proceedings, and when you're putting witnesses in videos and you're making legal arguments and you're showing the evidence, it can be a very effective process to get that out. And the Merchants of Death, I don't know if you know this, but we took our name from the original Merchants of Death of World War I, right? So it was discovered after World War I that U.S. business had led the U.S. into war, and Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota began congressional hearings in the 1930s. And he put witnesses on, just as we did, right? And he had disclosed all these documents, and it showed big business took us into war for profit. And people, Americans, were outraged. During the 1930s, there were tens of thousands of college students that took oaths pledging that they would never fight in a European war. Farmers and factory workers and laborers across the country all marched together against war. And it was really moving in the right direction. These hearings were exposing folks. But what happened was big business pushed back. Senator Nye's committee got defunded. Big business started running articles in the press, pillaring Senator Nye. And they started running stories favorable to them. And then, of course, Hitler rises, and the Nazis rise in Germany because of the failure of World War I, and we're back to where we started again. But what we need to do is to continue to press on because, you know, here we are 100 years later, and we seemingly did not learn the lesson, particularly from World War I, because when I was reading about World War I, it was interesting. The soldiers in the trenches of World War I, that's where they first started to talk about the concept of an endless war. And they used that phrase, endless war, because they were joking with each other how the next generation and a generation after that was going to have to continue to fight this war, because they saw there was no purpose in this war, there was no end in sight, and it was going to go on forever. They didn't realize that they were right. They were accurate. That actually happened. So again, who are these merchants of death? Very quickly, Lockheed Martin in 2023 made $64 billion. Raytheon made $40 billion. Northrop Grumman made $35 billion. General Dynamics, $33 billion. Big money for these people, and they spend a lot of money to get it. I talked last night about the 800 lobbyists they have on Capitol Hill, the $20 million they poured into the 2020 campaign cycle. They're probably double that amount this time around. And again, it works because the NDAA keeps getting higher and higher every year. I think that if most Americans knew how this whole process worked, they would be against it. They would not want their tax dollars going to increase the bottom line of shareholders and corporate entities. They would not favor war for profit. They believe that their lives are in danger and it needs to be defended, which it's not. It's for profit. It's for increasing the bottom line. So, going back to T.S. Eliot's poem, just to conclude here, in the wasteland, and this is a wonderful poem, and it's not that long. It's only 444 lines. And Eliot was hopeful in the sense that even though he thought that the land may have been killed, he thought there were enough fragments of civilization left that you could pull those fragments together and bring civilization back together. So the second to last line in that poem are the Hindu religious words, da, da, da. And each da, that da, da, da is meant to be the sound of God, the sound of thunder. And each da stands for something else. It means to give, to sympathize, and to relinquish control. So these are meant to be eternal watchwords for us all to embrace, because the very last line of that poem, does anybody know what the last line of The Wasteland is? What? Did somebody say? Shanti. Shanti. It's the Sanskrit word shanti, which means peace. It means peace which surpasses all understanding, the peace that can save us. So the peace is not going to happen on its own. As Dan Berrigan said, and as I have in my salutation on all my emails, peace is a verb. We have to make the peace. We all have to be peacemakers. We have to take a risk. If it doesn't cost us something, it's probably not worth it. We're going to have to bend the arc. And we can do that. We've done that in the past, and we can do that in the future. So I'm going to close with a quote from Phil Berrigan from my book, Ministry of Risk. I never leave home without it. But I think this quote really goes to the heart of what we need to do and what Phil did in his life and his witness. And it's where I got the title of the book. I found this my first day in the archives at Cornell University when I was doing the research. I pulled out this unpublished speech that Phil had given in 1973. He was at the ordination of another priest, and so Phil was giving this speech, and it was kind of him passing the torch to a new generation of Catholic priests and saying, this is what you're going to need to do. And the title of it was A Ministry of Risk and Liberation, and I thought, that's the title of the book. That's perfect. So, and this is where it comes from. A ministry of risk goes unerringly to the side of the victims, to those threatened or destroyed by greed, prejudice, and war. From the side of those victims, it teaches two simple, indispensable lessons. Number one, that we all belong in the ditch or in the breach with the victims. And number two, that until we go to the ditch or into the breach, victimizing will not cease.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode started with a speech by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington, on February 22, 2025. The theme of the conference was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. We then heard Brad Wolf's speech at the 26th Annual Qatari Peace Conference held in Fonda, New York, on September 13th and 14th, 2024. Brad Wolf is executive director and co-founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. A former lawyer, prosecutor, professor, and community college dean, he recently edited a new book of the writings of Philip Berrigan entitled A Ministry of Risk. I'm Wilton Vaught saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.